CJAM 99.1 FM, your only true sound alternative in Windsor, Detroit. CJAM broadcasts from the University of Windsor locally at 99.1 FM and to the world at www.cjam.ca.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Magna Carta Pro Bono Radio on CGM 99.1 FM. This is Victor, your host for this afternoon, along with your co-host, Mark. If you're tuning in for the first time, I would like to welcome you to our show and offer a quick recap of what our organization, Pro Bono Students, or PBSC, is all about. Pro Bono Students Canada is a national organization of pro bono students with chapters in 22 Canadian law schools. Our chapter here at Windsor fits in quite well with our school's values of social justice and offers many law school volunteers a chance to make an impact with organizations to deliver legal services to those in need and lack resources to retain legal counsel. All projects at PBSC are under supervision by a practicing lawyer. And to everyone listening, all of our previous shows are available online at www.cjm.ca. So if you missed any of our previous shows, go on and give it a listen in the archives. Now, as per usual, before we get into any legal topic discussions, we'd just like to remind our audience that anything said on this radio talk show reflects the opinions of these people only and does not necessarily reflect those of CJAM as a radio station or Pro Bono Students Canada. So, right now, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about the news article that we've selected for today?
Cool. So, I think this article hits a little close to home for a lot of us, especially students. Whether that be undergraduate, graduate, or professional degrees, just because this is a topic that frequently comes up. And yeah, so today the article is called Mind the Gap. Canadians are talking about mental health, but getting care is still often out of reach, from the Globe and Mail. So this article pretty much does a survey of mental health resources in Canada, you know. One thing that it sort of highlights is that we as a nation, we often talk so much about mental health and there's all this about awareness and whatnot. But then it seems that it's just that. It's all talk. When it really comes down to it, the resources just aren't there for people to access it. To directly quote the article, it says, psychiatric care is hard or impossible to find in some parts of the country. Police are being forced into the role of frontline mental health workers. And at school and in the workforce, Canadians' need for care is growing.
Yeah,
that's like, that's almost scary to think that the issue has become so widespread that our own resources can't handle it, and it's police that are dealing with it. And I don't even think I need to mention about the stories that go on when it comes with when it comes to police dealing with people with mental health.
Of course,
there sadly is too many of them.
Right.
So the article mentions that Montreal and Greater Vancouver has more than a third. Okay, more than a third of psychiatrists in Canada. And those two big cities, more than a third, man. And a Globe and Mail analysis found that half of Canadians live in regions with too few psychiatrists for the ratio recommended by a panel of experts. So the numbers are about 2.3 million people are in areas with no permanent psychiatrists at all.
This is incredibly difficult to swallow because, you know, for many people with mental health issues, psychiatry absolutely can make a difference. But for many others as well, they simply aren't aware of these resources. And in some cases, even when they are available, people either can't access them or can't afford them.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a huge access issue here. And while it is fair to point out that, you know, the police as an organization should not really have to take on this burden themselves, we want to, of course, still clarify that with regards to the police performing their functions as law enforcement, that is a separate issue from them performing their functions while performing a sort of thrust upon them function as psychiatrists, which is not fair to hold them to that standard, of course. Whatever is expected of them in their regular duties, of course, it should be expected. But in this capacity, it is difficult to imagine having them take over such a crucial role in the community.
It is. It's almost adding another duty for the police to handle. And the fact of the matter is, and not until recently, and even still, many police forces aren't equipped to deal with the issues regarding mental health.
Exactly. Not to mention the issues within the police themselves as well. Right? They also go through, especially considering the nature of their job, there is a considerable amount of trauma and really stress and anxiety that must come with that job, certainly to have such a responsibility. So within and without, it really is certainly a large issue that needs to be addressed.
Exactly. And right now, the article actually cites that there's sort of a crisis amongst us. And I don't want to have everyone up in arms and running around.
Of course.
I think of that SpongeBob scene where he's looking for a memory and all the little SpongeBobs in his head
Classic. Are
running through the file cabinets and everything sets on fire.
Yes.
No. It's just something to be aware of in the coming years. In the article, they mentioned that half of the nation's psychiatrists are older than 55, and low pay, long hours, and high burnout rates are deterring young people from choosing psychiatry as a vocation.
That is...
The profession is essentially aging out, and the conditions of people who were actually in that profession aren't juicy enough for the next generation to wake up and say, hey, you know what? Yeah, I think I want to be a psychiatrist. And that leaves us with another issue, because who's going to handle the brunt of it? Are we just going to move these duties to other areas? Or, I don't know how to address this. And there's also an issue with how they go about training psychiatrists. And there's one possible solution that the article cites, and that's requiring psychiatrists in training to do residencies in underserved areas, or making telepsychiatry more available to rural and northern patients, which I think is interesting because when you look at med schools, I'm barely sure that they have a lot of opportunities to go to underserved areas. And I know with nursing, especially, don't hold me to this though, but I know with nursing, there are a lot of positions in these underserved areas that they're actually trying all that they can do to bring people there. Like my aunt, she ended up going up north, really? And it paid significantly more than it would in a metropolitan area, just because they don't have those people there. Yes. Their article also talks about the fact that when people do reach out for mental health issues, Canada sort of has a way of care that they cite as coercive care. Coercive care, yeah.
What is that?
So, essentially, people will reach out and they'll say, hey, I'm going through something, I need help.
Yes.
And rather than working with the patient and going about it step by step, they jump to DEFCON 5 immediately.
Oh, my.
So, they actually talk about Anna Meller-Paperny, who's a former Globe and Mail journalist. She unfortunately attempted suicide, and she ended up writing a book about it called Hello, I Want to Die, Please Fix Me. In it, she talks about how she was sent to involuntary psychiatric care. And that's not out of the norm. Yeah. Where essentially the terminology here could be wrong, but from my limited understanding of it is that they sort of diminish your rights a little bit. They take you into the hospital and you don't sort of have as much agency over yourself as you normally would. And this is supposed to be held for the most extreme of cases, but what the Globe and Mail found is that this is happening a lot more. So, for example, between 2008 and 2017, involuntary admissions in the province of Ontario rose by nearly 90%.
90%.
So it's almost as if, I don't know what's going on, but like the profession doesn't know how to deal with these smaller cases, or it's simply easier just to say, okay, you know what, we'll throw you here and lock away the keys.
That's.
There's a bunch of issues with this.
Of course.
They call it forms, and that's essentially when they, like, it's a part of this course of care. And although they're very important to the system, again, they're being used too much, and they can kill someone's trust in the medical system, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, imagine you go for a little problem, and you're like, okay, I want to see a therapist maybe 2-3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that big of an issue. Like, I know I can get through it. But instead they say, no, you know what? We're going to lock you up in this hospital for a couple of weeks to a month or even more. And yeah, we'll see what happens then.
And this is true too, in the sense of like the frequency of being able to see a psychiatrist or a therapist is certainly something that, because of the really the quite severe gap between supply and demand, is that many people are often forced to wait long periods before they can even see someone, even if there is a psychiatrist available.
Right.
I know that the most frequent you could typically get to see one at school here, for example, is around about 2 weeks, every 2 weeks, because simply put, there's so many students and there really aren't enough psychiatrists.
Wow. You know, that's actually good. I know another school, I'm not going to mention them, just, you know, liability issues, but I know at some other schools that wait can span up to months.
Yes.
I know some people telling me stories of them only being able to see a psychiatrist once a semester.
It's very difficult, and there's never enough time when you're there. But it is the reality that we live in, and, you know, in so much as we can do, I think it's great that you shared this article, because given that we have our specific voice on the radio and given the opportunity to share this issue with many people who are listening in the greater Windsor, Detroit area, it is definitely something that everyone, you know, can speak up about. If nothing else, just having your voice heard is certainly something.
Exactly. You know, and at the top of this portion, I mentioned how police are on the front lines and they're dealing with it ever more.
Right.
And the article mentions that when Canadians' mental health and illnesses lead them to hurt themselves or others, it's more likely than ever that police are going to be the ones to deal with it. And there's just all these systemic issues have led to a shift where, rather than having long-term goals and long-term efforts,
right,
there's all these short-term solutions. And it's also adding to the hospital, the overcrowding of hospital emergency rooms, because people just aren't going to the right places. They're not being sent. They're not being directed.
Yeah.
For example, again, I'm not going to mention schools, but I've heard anecdotes of people who they would go to one department at the school and say, hey, I'm dealing with this issue. I need help. Who do I go to? And they say, oh, no worries. We'll set you up with an appointment with this group like next week. And they're like, okay. They show up and they're like, okay, like I have a problem, blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, cool. We'll send you to this group over there.
Musical chairs, hot potato.
Right? And they just keep getting bounced around. Sometimes they'll never even get to the point where they see someone. And sometimes they do, which is like, which is what you would expect, that after, you know, bouncing around for a bit, they'll see someone. And I don't want to blame these universities, because as this article clearly states, this is an issue that's widespread across the nation.
Yes.
So if you can imagine how bad it is for students, and you have to think, like, at universities, we're kind of spoiled. Like,
we have so many resources.
Like, we have a chiropractor on campus. We have a dentist. Some schools have their own, like, doctor, their own physician.
Yes.
Some schools have, like, their own massage therapist. Like, you know, like, all we have
campus.
All these,
yes.
Right? And to think that we're spoiled and we're still struggling.
And I wouldn't even say spoiled. This really is something that, like, we shouldn't consider a luxury to be able to have these resources. After all, I mean, the way we see it, you could even argue these are some basic human necessities. It's just unfortunate, given that the lack of supply elsewhere makes it seem like that we are spoiled. But I don't think it's necessarily a fair categorization like that, because
no.
It's not like we don't need them or anything. It's like a luxury. It's not a Lamborghini. It's really just a basic vehicle that we need to get around.
Exactly. And the article actually mentions that, how students are reaching out more frequently than ever, you know? One, there's more resources available in terms of, like, actually recognizing. I was actually listening to a podcast. I want to say it was Front Burner or The Daily by CBC. And there was one episode that I got from it where they were talking about how this generation is the anxiety generation. And they don't necessarily know if it's because there are different and more stressors in our life, or if we're just more able to identify them.
I think it's a bit of both, too.
And, yeah.
There was a and I can't remember if it was on Netflix or something, but there was a show that was discussing this. And what they said was, actually, historically speaking, levels of anxiety have not actually increased necessarily. It's more just that people are aware of it, and now their reporting is more accurate. But I think there's a point to be said, too. Now that was, you know, phone, social media, internet, things move quickly, and it's hard to process things the way that sometimes they need time to process. And in our 24-hour news cycle with social media now, things move on really quickly. Sometimes, you know, you talk with someone about something, and by the end of the conversation, it's already irrelevant.
Right, right. So with the post-secondary schools, with the fact that, like, let's assume that, yeah, it's both. You know, we're recognizing mental health problems before they get worse, and also there's a different kind of stress that we're experiencing, different kinds of anxieties.
Yes.
These schools can't keep up.
No.
Because there's a sudden shift where you have all these people who are starting to recognize and who already know, and it's, yeah, you know? Then the last part of this article mentions how the Toronto-based Center for Addiction and Mental Health is starting to partner with a lot of workplaces. Because that's another area.
Is this CAMH we're speaking of?
Pardon?
CAMH.
This
the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. CAMH, is CAMH. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so used to seeing, like, CAMH that I often forget what that actually stands for.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying that, like, the mental health issues that plague workplaces add a $51 billion with a B, annual economic burden in sick leave, lost productivity, and other costs.
Not to mention the mental toll, not just the economical toll, but the mental toll
so,
and the people involved.
This is an issue that spans all aspects of our life. Schools, the workplace, and just the institution in general, you know?
And speaking of the institution, I mean, our guest today is Stephanie. She works for Innocence Canada, and definitely their project involving, you know, wrongful convictions involves a lot of this mental health thing as well. It's an issue that doesn't just stretch schools and workplaces, but also the criminal law system.
And that brings us to the topic for today. Our guest is Stephanie Novak, who works for Innocence Canada. So, for those of you who've usually watched this, you'll know that we typically have students on the show. But Stephanie is a bit higher in the pecking order. This is going to be a really cool episode. She'll explain that later. So, Innocence Canada actually partners with PBSC's Wrongful Conviction Outreach Project. We are excited to learn all about that today. Thank you for coming in, and please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Novak. I'm the Director of Education for Innocence Canada. I've been doing this for about 2 years now. Actually, my anniversary of 2 years was just a couple of days ago.
Wow.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Cool. So can you just tell us, like, a little bit of background, like, so where you're from, things that you like to do, and just any general facts?
Sure. So I like long walks on the beach. I'm actually from Montreal and moved to Toronto about 6 years ago. And I've always been really interested in law and social justice, so Innocence Canada was a natural fit. What do I like? I like reading a lot. This year I challenged myself to read a minimum of 30 books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, with the enormous amount of free time that I have, 30 is a lot, let's just say. It's ambitious, but I'm pretty excited about it.
It's always good to set ambitious plans.
Yeah.
Yeah, how close are you?
I've already read 4. And
nice,
I'm reading
nice.
2 right now.
Oh, my God. Wait, it's only January.
Wow. Just January.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's good.
Travel helps.
I should probably start doing my own readings, eh?
If only they're props, dude.
Oh, yeah. So what did you do for your educational background?
So I actually studied translation from French to English at Concordia University, and I did a minor in Mandarin and Chinese Cultural Studies, where I got to do an exchange in Hangzhou in the Zhejiang province of China.
Wow. Jindama.
Cool. So last week, we actually had someone on the show who came from out west in BC, and I sort of put them on the spot by asking them if they like Ontario or BC better. So I'm going to do the same with you. How do you like Ontario so far, and do you think that it's better than Quebec yet?
Well, that's quite a controversial question to be asking. They're both just so completely different from each other. But I will say one thing that Quebec has over Ontario is bread. It is so hard to find a good baguette, a good croissant, all these delicious breads that I'm used to having every day, just freshly baked. It's really, really challenging to find. So yeah. I will say Quebec does have that over.
Oh, absolutely. I haven't found a single bakery near our school's vicinity.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. And honestly, I was in Montreal over the New Year's, and I finally had their poutine. Did I say that right?
Poutine.
Yes.
Poutine.
Yes. Poutine. It was amazing. I had the Montreal smoked meat one, and it was just...
And you can't go back now.
Oh, no. If I go to, like, Smoked Poutinery or something, I'm just going to look at them and say, this isn't it.
Yeah.
This isn't it.
Little known fact, I've never eaten a poutine in Ontario.
Honestly, the authentic experience. I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Yeah. So what's your actual title at Innocence Canada? Because we did mention that you're a bit higher in the pecking order.
Yeah, so I'm the director of education, which means that I run all the educational initiatives at the organization, which encompasses about a million different things, to be quite honest, whether that be, you know, managing the website and creating content for that, delivering educational programming to law students, creating continuing professional development for legal professionals and other people in the justice sector. It's really just a wide range of things that basically allows me to just talk, which I like.
Wow, incroyable.
Oh, merci. Mm.
Yeah, so then, like, do you get to travel with that then? Since, like, you're actually in Windsor right now, so is that part of the job?
So part of the job is a little bit of travel, yes. Obviously, we are a small nonprofit, so in terms of funding and that sort of thing, we try and be, you know, responsible about how we spend it. So that's actually one of the reasons why this PBSC project came about. Really, it's so much of it is about harnessing the power of law students in their communities to spread the word that I can't necessarily reach. I mean, I can't go to Saskatoon every month,
right,
or Victoria every month, or Windsor every month. So it's really about harnessing them and their passions and
Absolutely.
Sending them out into the world.
Yeah. So can you tell us a bit about your student team and how they've been spreading the message of PBSC through the in community outreach program, as well as Incident Canada's overall agenda with this program?
Yeah, so we started this project. It's actually a new project this year that we're doing with PBSC. And essentially what it is to empower people who may have been incarcerated or have been wrongfully incarcerated and wrongfully convicted to understand a little bit more about this very unique section of the criminal code, section 696.1 to 696.6. So it just kind of helps take them through the steps of what that is, but
Absolutely.
Also how these things happen. What are some of the main causes of a wrongful conviction? So that they can then examine their own case and think about it and just sort of empower them to see if there's a way that they can pursue having this miscarriage of justice rectified.
Wow, absolutely. So I think our prof, Professor David Tanovich, certainly has a lot to say on this area.
He sure does.
Very fortunate to have him teaching us all about really the justice system in Canada beyond just the scope of the textbook. So I know here at Windsor Law, we do have a more of a social justice focus in our education. So it's great for us to get a different perspective on the law, perhaps from where some other schools might focus more on like the textbook criminal analysis. Professor Tanovich really goes out of his way to show us the social context evidence, tell us more about the rationale and the thinking behind judgments and how they can affect not only people, but communities as well.
That's amazing. David Tanovich, Professor Tanovich, is absolutely fantastic. His writings have been incredible throughout the years. I just devour every article that he posts on social media. And he's just such a great ally in this fight. And you're so lucky to be able to be taught by him.
Yeah, he's honestly such an amazing prof.
Professor, if you're listening to this, shout out to you.
we'll let you know you're on the show.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned before, you're actually in Windsor right now. Can you sort of talk more to why you're here?
Sure. So, Windsor Law every year puts on this Justice at Work conference. And for the past 2 years, Innocence Canada has participated. We stand around. Technically, I'm supposed to have pamphlets, but small nonprofit. I have a business card. And just talk about our work and how students can get involved in social justice organizations, or just, you know, whatever it is, what questions they have, how can they get involved in perhaps criminal law if that's something that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. So really just talking to people and informing them.
Yeah. And both sides of criminal law too.
Yeah.
A lot of times I think we think of wrongful convictions as more of a defense issue, but it kind of does stem from the prosecution to begin with, pursuing some of these charges.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of criminal law, because while, yeah, you know, we have this notion of, you know, the defense counsel, it's their responsibility, it is the Crown's responsibility also, but it also comes from police. Yes. And their tunnel vision and their investigation, or forensic scientists who make claims that might be out of their scope. It's quite multidisciplinary.
Absolutely.
And there's just so many things that come into play. So yeah, it is. It's kind of all sides.
Yeah, law enforcement really is a multifaceted puzzle that everything needs to go together for it to come.
So how did you get involved with Innocence Canada? And has this been something that's always been on your mind, or was it just an opportunity you couldn't pass up?
So I got involved. I used to work at PBSC, full disclosure.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Full circle, eh?
Right? I loved PBSC. I love them still. They're such a great program. They hold a very special place in my heart. I ran 11 law school chapters in English common law, French common law, French civil law, so basically in every way possible that you can practice the law in Canada. And then this opportunity came up through a friend of mine, and it was just, how could you say no to doing this kind of work? I just couldn't. So it was heartbreaking to leave PBSC, but I do everything I can to partner with them in any way. They're so great, and I just love what I do now.
Absolutely. We really appreciate you coming into this.
And I just want to interrupt and say, wow. Oh, my God.
I love it.
Wow. You're so interesting. just from this, short conversation already, I've learned so much. Yeah, wow.
This is why we do it. All right, Stephanie. So I've heard of actually the Innocence Project, which was founded in 92 by Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck at the Cardozo School of Law in New York. Is that really the start of this Innocence Canada, or is this kind of a separate chapter? What's sort of the history with the Innocence Canada?
So it's really interesting. We have a great relationship with the Innocence Network and Innocence Projects and support their work 100%, just as they do us. They're absolutely fantastic. I mean, if you just see all the work that they're doing in the news, it's unbelievable. But we actually are not an Innocence Project. We're separate entities. And the reason is that in Canada, it's different. The law is different here. And so we, given our nonprofit status, given the fact that we're, you know, six individuals working in an office for this, our limited capacity and our caseload is at over 90 at this point.
Wow.
We really must focus on the Canadian context and Canadian wrongful convictions.
Absolutely.
So that's why. But, you know, we still, you know, very much support them. And I absolutely am always in amazement of the work that they do down there. They're absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel that with Canadian people in general, we find that this issue of wrongful conviction tends to be more of an American issue? We always see the American cases. We think of it more as an American issue. But do you think the Canadian justice system has, done its part to make sure that convictions are done properly?
So I think that, you know, Canada is known as for having, you know, possibly arguably the best justice system in the world. We do things really well here, but the truth of the matter is that, yes, people think of this as an American issue because you see it coming out so much more, but Canada, our system, just like every legal system in the world, is, you know, sort of executed by human beings.
Yes.
And human beings make mistakes. So there are bound to be errors within our justice system as well. What's important is that we work to correct them as quickly and efficiently as possible so that innocent individuals don't have to suffer for this.
Absolutely.
Man, that's That's fascinating. Like, you always see the TV shows or the movies that talk about, like, the wrongful convictions and what people sort of do to get out of it. And it's kind of a shame that we always look at the Innocence Project in the U.S. when we have our own, like, bolstering project here that's doing so well. So with that, can you sort of, like, give us an inside scoop of some things that Innocence Canada has done recently?
Sure. So we are riding high right now. Things have been going really, really well. We submitted 2 696 applications. Recently, we are sort of also riding the high of the exoneration of Glenn Assoon out in Nova Scotia.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you. So that was last March, that was our latest exoneration. He's an incredible man, and we're just so, so happy to see him finally get that moment.
Can you provide some context into this exoneration?
Sure. So Glenn Assoon was, I want to say, in 1998, convicted of the homicide of his ex-girlfriend in Halifax. I'm not going to get too into the details because it's very, very convoluted.
Of course.
But essentially, he didn't commit the crime, obviously. Yes. And there was a strong likelihood that it could have been an actual serial killer in the area.
Oh, my. And
in March was when he got his retrial, and there was no evidence called, essentially, and he went on. If you actually want to know more, because it is quite convoluted, W5 did a show on him. Yes, quite recently, and I can't remember what it's called. I'm so sorry.
Oh, we'll take a look for sure. Google is the greatest thing.
Glenn Assoon, W5. It's on YouTube, and it's really fascinating.
And how are we spelling Assoon for those who are?
Assoon.
Oun.
And okay. Glenn has only one N.
Oh, okay. GlennAssoon.
Spelling me champion.
cool. So, is this, like, again, something that you always sort of wanted to get into? Like, I guess growing up, were you into the true crime or what's that one show? SVU.
Law and Order.
CSI. Law and Order. CSI.
Those
like,
type of shows.
I cannot stand David Caruso.
Oh my.
Aside, for my birthday, my cousin once made me a David Caruso pinata. So.
Oh, wow. I love that.
You never know. So when I was growing up, which was, I would say, decades ago at this point, not to reveal too much information.
we can tell.
But we really didn't have that much true crime. It was more like Rescue 911 was sort of the thing, or that one with the really terrifying music that came right after Rescue 911. I'm sure people my age will be yelling at their radios saying, it's this. I can't remember for the life of me. So not really. It's quite a new phenomenon, this true crime thing with making a murderer and serial coming out and then just sort of exploding.
Constantly.
I just kind of knew I always wanted to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to do something that was making a difference, that was helping people and that was helping them to learn. I think education is so important and so empowering, and without it, you know, you can be quite at a loss. So I really knew that that was sort of the way I wanted to go. And then as my career progressed, because after I finished university, I went completely in the other direction and started working at McGill Law in their student affairs office. So just sort of one thing after another led me to this, and it just feels right.
That's fantastic to hear. You know, actually, I was browsing Twitter recently, and I saw something very interesting in the ad section. Now, I don't know if anyone in the audience has ever heard of these individuals, but I think they're pretty internationally renowned actors.
Mm-hmm. What are their names?
One of them goes by the name of Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
That fellow.
Yeah, Michael, and there's this other guy. I think his name is like Jamie something.
Starts with the F.
Maybe Jamie Foxx.
Maybe Jamie Foxx.
And maybe Wonder Woman.
Brie Larson herself.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So
tell us a bit about those ads. And Just Mercy, the movie partnering with Innocence Canada, which we're getting A-list Hollywood celebrities to endorse our cause.
Yeah, this was a huge deal for us. We were so excited to work with Warner Brothers on this project. They have been absolutely incredible, to say the least, and really shedding light in Canada on this issue, because it's true, a lot of people, as mentioned earlier, think of this as an American issue. It's not something that happens here, but really putting it in people's faces that this is a problem in Canada as well that we need to fix. And so in our partnership came these videos where Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, Brie Larson, and Bryan Stevenson himself, mm-hmm. who is unbelievable. If you don't know who Bryan Stevenson is, you should definitely go check that out. The book and the film are both based on him. Mm-hmm. They each recorded a sort of 60-second spot about one of our cases of wrongful conviction or wrongful convictions in general. And they're just incredibly powerful voices, and we were just so thankful that they agreed to do it. And I think they did a great job. There's actually a compilation of all the videos playing, I believe, in front of at the beginning of the Bombshell film and also the Richard Jewell film. Wow. So if you happen to see them, you'll likely see this spot for Innocence Canada that's giving us national coverage.
National, international coverage, yeah. Really. This has been on international Twitter.
Yeah.
And certainly, I was on the side too, I was going to mention Brie Larson, another Francais Canadien.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wait, actually?
Yeah, her father is French Canadian. She spoke French as her first language.
Oh, that's so cool.
Says Wikipedia.
So cool. Do you think maybe I should write her an email and say, hey, we should be friends?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who couldn't pass it off to be friends with Captain Marvel?
Oh, right? Even maybe convince her to come on this lovely little show here.
Yeah, huh? Winter could definitely use the pull.
Yeah, I'll get right on that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's. I just want to say, I didn't even know about like the little 60-second ads. That's so cool. How did you guys land that? That's amazing.
It's just through this partnership with Warner Brothers. I mean, they've been, like I said, they've been amazing to us, and they really have been supporting us and supporting the cause and wanting to put this front and center and make an impact. And it's just such a great way to see sort of what we think of as a large corporation actually. Who cares and is really making a difference and partnering with, you know, a small nonprofit like us and just, I just think it's such a perfect marriage between us and it's been so wonderful. I cannot express how grateful we all are for, mm-hmm. for having this opportunity.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about Just Mercy and Bryan Stevenson's story?
Sure. So Just Mercy talks about the wrongful conviction of Walter McMillian. My mistake. I've only seen the movie four times and read the book, you know, but this life is hard. What do you want me to say? the life of Bryan Stevenson when he got out of law school as a young lawyer, full of ambition, starting the Equal Justice Initiative in the States down south and wanting to work with really people who he felt, or what I presume, who he felt were sort of cast aside by society and forgotten and really wanted to make a difference. And so death row sort of kind of comes top of mind. Once you're on death row, people just generally may not care as much about you. And so really working with those individuals and his fight to prove Walter's innocence. Yes. And it's a really fascinating story.
Yes, especially considering that, you know, here in Canada, we don't have the death penalty, but the consequences in the U.S. for a wrongful conviction can be as severe as any. There really is no coming back from that.
No. There's
no need to say, of course.
It's quite massive. Yeah.
And it's interesting to know that Bryan Stevenson, a Harvard law graduate, mm-hmm. probably could have done whatever law he wanted to, and he chose instead to really champion this cause.
He did, and he's still doing this work to this day. I mean, what an incredibly inspiring individual he is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And now he's sharing his message, our message, all across Canada as well. So yeah. This has been a great partnership for sure.
We're so grateful.
Right. So at this point, we're going to take a little short break, and we'll be right back with Magna Carta Pro Bono Radio after some messages.
Hey, University of Windsor students. Do you have late classes? Are you new in town or just feel nervous or unsafe when walking alone? Download the Safe Lancer app and use FriendWalk. FriendWalk lets you send your location in real time to a friend so they make sure you get to your destination safely. If you or your friend suspects you are in danger, either of you can trigger a call to emergency services. When you reach your destination, finish your trip and disconnect safely. A message brought to you by the University of Windsor Campus Police Services. The Safe Lancer app is available for Android and Apple devices.
And we're back. You're listening to CJAM 99.1 Magna Carta Pro Bono Radio. Before the break, we were discussing the Wrongful Convictions Project and Innocence Canada with Stephanie Novak. So, now that we're back, I just want to sort of switch the conversation a little bit and talk more about the pro bono side of things. What is your role in regard to that?
So, all PBSC projects, and I know this because I work there, need to have an organization supervisor and a lawyer supervisor. So one thing is that, first off, I'm not actually a lawyer. I didn't go to law school. And also, I don't live here. So we have two amazing lawyer supervisors in Windsor helping us out, and two wonderful students doing it. And I'm sort of the organization supervisor and sort of set that expectation and assist with any information about Innocence Canada that they need.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about what the project's been up to these past two semesters?
Sure. So they are reaching out to organizations in your community and people who work with either currently or previously incarcerated individuals, and teaching them about wrongful convictions and wrongful conviction work, the causes, how to go about rectifying a miscarriage of justice within our criminal code, the process, and about Innocence Canada and the work that we do specifically to assist. Also, just as an aside, Innocence Canada works exclusively in homicide convictions, simply due to the fact that, you know, we are a small organization. Nice. Empowering people who may have been convicted of a lesser crime, I put in quotation marks, lesser crime, to allow them the chance to potentially have their conviction reviewed.
So, are the projects sort of the same across all the schools, or do different schools have different focuses?
So at the moment, we're actually running two different types of projects. This first one is running at multiple schools throughout Canada. It's very similarly done. And then we have another special project out in BC, where students are actually working directly with one of our board members on cases or a case of wrongful conviction, and assisting in that. So, that's pretty cool too.
Oh, absolutely. So are there any specific projects in Windsor that are being worked on, or are you not able to discuss these right now?
So the project that we're doing here is the education one, where the students are going out into the community. We also recently decided to potentially present to youth and high schools, because personally, I think it's very important to teach people from the beginning what their rights are and how these things can happen, because they can carry that through. And also, we all know that this generation of kids are very energetic, let's just say, and very committed to making social changes. So, you know, why not start that off a bit earlier and get them to know what this is?
Yeah, fantastic. And I do want to think about, you know, the awareness of rights and issues is something that everyone should know. But isn't it interesting that a lot of people aren't aware of their charter rights? And when they're interacting with law enforcement, they're not sure of when they can, keep their mouth shut even. I remember our Professor Tenevich was telling us that, like, if he got in an interrogator, they could have gotten us to confess to any crime in just 10 minutes. And they actually had done that in class.
Yeah, I have a friend who took a program in psychology, and he learned about, like, all the interrogation stuff. And over the summer, you know, I was just working with the city, you know, hanging out, and he's bragging about it. I'm like, okay, whatever, you can't do anything. And he does it. He literally comes up to me, like, stares down at me and starts asking me questions. And I'm confessing to things that, like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And the fact that someone who had, like, maybe less than a semester of, like, knowledge was able to do that, like, I couldn't even imagine what, like, law enforcement can do.
And it's interesting. I mean, the charter is all available online. Everyone knows where to find it. But at the end of the day, when you're in that situation, so many people just don't invoke their rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to the fact that, you know, as a society and people in general, right, you're kind of on a need-to-know basis. You know, unless you're truly interested in this thing, in the law, you know, you don't really think of it and how it affects your life and what you may need to know, because you don't actually think of this ever happening to you, or you getting arrested or being charged. So you don't invest the time. It's only after the fact that you realize this knowledge would have been really important. But I think that's also part of, you know, legal education and the sort of the responsibility of lawyers is to deliver this information and provide plain language information to people in an accessible way. And so,
the plain language part.
You know, plain language is it's quite challenging when you think about it. You know, we're all used to speaking at a certain level or speaking in a certain way, and we all understand each other. And
legalese,
right? So it's very interesting, and I think pulling from other disciplines, very much like wrongful conviction work, we, you know, it's not just about the law. It's about forensics. It's about psychiatrists. It's about language. It's about body language. It's about so much more than just the law. So pulling from all of this in a way that and explaining it to people in a way that they can understand is so important.
Absolutely. And, you know, in criminal law, one of the principles is ignorance of the law is no defense, but ignorance of your rights. Shouldn't that be a factor as well? Many people, when they're convicted, they will say, well, I didn't know the law, and they would generally not know the law. But that's not held to be a defense in criminal law. But when people aren't aware of their rights and they get convicted, that's a separate issue as well. So being aware of your rights, I think, is absolutely something that anyone in that situation, whether they're, you know, whatever they've done in any interaction with law enforcement, people need to be aware of their rights. And, you know, it is worth reminding here that we are, as law students, are not offering any legal advice. And this is merely our opinion that's being expressed. However, with that being said, I think, Mark, you agree as well, right? That awareness of your rights and any interaction with law enforcement is absolutely something that every individual should have, regardless of whether or not you're in any sort of incident.
Yeah, and I definitely think that that applies to every facet of your life. Like, during my undergrad, I lived in a student housing for a little bit, and the landlord sometimes would try to, you know, sneak a little things here and there, and luckily, I lived with an older student who understood the ropes and knew what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. But yeah, it really applies to all areas of life. But just as an aside, you mentioned about not everyone knowing the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and everything. There's just like meme going on Twitter and TikTok where people are practicing, like, I don't know, like giving money to like the convenience store guy for candy for the first time. And they do like different versions. Like, you can't see me right now, but like they'll do it like behind their back, or like you'll give a wink or something. And there was one video where the guy had the entire Charter of Rights and Freedoms, like the official version, printed on his wall with absolutely no explanation whatsoever. Like, I mean, it was just a blank wall and the official charter just there. And all of us were like, what is going on? And he's like, I just love my rights, man. And I was like, wow,
that guy is cool.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And again, everyone out there, it's available online. Read up your charter rights. Make sure you know what you need to know.
And there are so many wonderful organizations that are specifically dedicated to this kind of work. Thinking of youth in particular, I think of OGEN and the amazing work that they do, the Ontario Justice Education Network, with youth to teach them about their rights. They are just absolutely fantastic. And there's so many more. I couldn't even name them all. So take advantage. It's out there.
Absolutely. And actually, it does bring me to our next topic, which is to say, do you feel like there are certain groups that are more vulnerable to this type of bias, let's say, from law enforcement? So with Innocence Canada, we're focusing specifically on murder or homicide issues, rather. But do you ever fear that there's a certain group of individuals, whether that be, as we talked about, youth not knowing their rights, or elderly, immigrants, maybe even racialized communities? Is there a more of a focus here, or is it just for general, for everyone?
So I think it's interesting. You know, the truth be told, anybody can fall victim to a miscarriage of justice. Anybody. You can, you know, I think of Ron Dalton, our co-president, who was a bank manager and ended up spending, you know, a decade or so in prison for a crime he didn't commit. You know, a highly educated man. I think about, you know, other clients that we've had that may be more racialized or marginalized, or are, not maybe, they are, who also fell victim to this. It really can affect anybody.
Yes.
But there are, of course, other factors that come into play that sort of compound the likelihood of this
course.
Happening. I mean, you think about Indigenous overrepresentation within our prison system. I mean, what are the chances, obviously, that there's probably more likelihood that there's some wrongful convictions there than elsewhere.
Absolutely.
So there are compounding factors. You know, one thing about Canada is that there's not a lot of research. It's not like the States where this topic is highly researched. And so you can find so many articles and information, so many studies being done about these things. For example, I think of the issue of women and wrongful convictions and how they're specifically affected by them. You know, there's a good amount of research in the States, but in Canada, there's really not that much. There's maybe one or two scholars that are focused on this. I mean, you know, you're lucky you have Professor Tanovich here, who's one of the foremost scholars in this area. I mean, he's absolutely fantastic and so thankful to him for the work he's doing. But, you know, it's not the same. You can't pull from the same sort of amount of resources.
For sure. And we're hoping that Professor Tanovich will inspire one of us to become that next researcher in this area.
I hope so.
Yeah. So since you work with almost all or pretty much all the law schools in Canada, do you notice certain issues being more prevalent in certain areas as it relates to this project?
So I think it's all, I draw back to my PBSC days. It's all very dependent on where you are and what community you're in, because each community is facing different issues, right? I think about, you know, in the prairies, there are more Indigenous people, or in the north, there's more Indigenous people. Whereas if you go to somewhere like Toronto, there's going to be more racialized individuals. So they're going to face certain differences. So of course, you know, depending on where you are, there are more likely to be different factors being at play. But, you know, in the end, a lot of this stuff is still the same biases that can affect everybody in the justice system in some way, shape, or form.
Okay. Yeah, and so the other thing I want to ask about, too, is with these biases. There's another sort of community that we haven't addressed. I think those with sort of mental health issues. Is there more of a targeting or profiling here, or are they more vulnerable to some of these wrongful convictions as well?
They're definitely more vulnerable. I think everybody can pull on the example of Brendan Dassey. If you haven't seen Making a Murderer, I don't know what rock you're living under, to be quite honest. You know, Brendan Dassey is a perfect example of a youth with a mental health issue, potentially more than one. I'm not sure. I'm not his doctor. And how he gets coerced into this confession and believing and putting that forward. You know, I think about in Canada, the case of Simon Marshall, which is a very fascinating case. I encourage everybody to look up, who confessed to multiple rapes when he actually didn't commit any of them because he suffered from severe issues. So it definitely is a way it's just another bias. It's another vulnerability that people are susceptible to and that people can take advantage of.
I think so too. And the intersection of all of these different factors is really something that it's impossible to encapsulate. Of course, a blanket solution is just to have everyone be aware of their rights, but it's just so difficult in so many circumstances when you're under pressure or there's other compounding factors in your interactions with law enforcement that could lead to, you know, potentially disastrous consequences.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, we focus here on law enforcement, but I will say, I mean, the justice system in general and what we've noticed at Innocence Canada, and I think every Innocence Network, Innocence Project, anybody who does this work, is that it's not one thing. It's never just, you know, oh, was that eyewitness, it's their fault, or oh, they confessed, or it's always a sort of the perfect storm of factors that come into play to create a wrongful conviction. So really, it's about looking at every single piece of it, you know, from the social sciences to the law to the people involved. I mean, there's so many different ways to come at the issue.
Exactly.
So you need a lot of different people working on this.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned earlier, there's so many players involved. That, you know, for example, whether it comes to forensic scientists or everyone involved in determining somebody's potential status for, it's, you know, something like mental health, for example, but amongst other things, right? So it's definitely really interesting to see just so many different ways, like you said, a perfect storm of things that can come across in a wrongful conviction.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of a puzzle, and it's a very intricate puzzle where you have to put together all the pieces to find and to see the big picture. It's really fascinating, really.
Yeah, and it's, you know, people think of, you know, we always think of these causes, but one thing I do want to address is, you know, how long it takes to unravel that and to unpack that puzzle and take the pieces out. You know, the system is slow.
Right, and the whole time that people, you know, are trying to unravel this mystery, the person in question, the accused, is in prison, or, you know, so there's definitely the element of, like, correcting a mistake takes time. But while everyone, including Innocence Canada, is working to rectify the mistake, the person is still suffering.
Yeah, you know, in fact, it's a lot of times they will have actually completed their sentence and be out by the time we're able to overturn a wrongful conviction. You know, at Innocence Canada, we have so many cases that we're at about a 3-year waiting period before we're even able to start looking at your case. You know, I think about Mr. Brian Anderson out of Winnipeg, a young Indigenous man. He was convicted in 1973. He served 10 years in prison. Goodness. And, you know, we submitted an application for him on behalf of him last year. So these take a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of money, and the criminal code, the way in which it's written, it just there's a lot of work that has to go into it. Let's just say.
Yeah, for sure. And it you know, it's hard to fix a mistake, but making a mistake in the first place could have just been, you know, like a brief instant. Could even have been unintentional.
Of course.
But the consequences, you know.
Yeah.
They keep coming.
They keep coming, and you know, we think about it as, you know, that prison time, but this is something that you keep for the rest of your life, right? Your Absolutely. Community labels you as this horrible person who's done this horrible crime. Yes. Sometimes for the rest of your life, even when it's overturned, people don't believe that that's the truth.
Exactly.
We want to believe our system works. You know, your family, your friends, you can be left quite alone, and it's really, really challenging to reintegrate to society. Imagine coming out of prison and you're trying to find a job, but you've been in there for, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yes.
Imagine you started and we used rotary phones and you come out and now we're using smartphones, just as a small example.
Yeah,
getting like used to
world,
that.
A whole different world.
It's a completely different world. Mm. So it's very challenging, and it's not something that goes away.
Mm-hmm. And those years, you never get them back.
Never.
But there are, so I guess by way of remedies, civil suits for regards to wrongful imprisonment. Mm-hmm. Is that something that Innocence Canada offers, or is that something the parties will have to seek on their own?
So Innocence Canada really focuses in on the criminal law aspect. We're mm-hmm. not civil lawyers, so, you know, obviously we don't want to go out of our area of expertise.
Of course.
We do put people in touch as much as possible with civil lawyers to review their claims. So we try and assist in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's up to the individual what they want to pursue.
Of course.
And whether or not they can pursue a civil claim.
Okay.
Cool. So we're going to start buckling down a little bit. And usually by this time of every show, we give an opportunity for our guests to sort of plug their organization a little bit. So in that sense, are there any opportunities for law students who aren't necessarily involved with PBSC to get involved with Innocence Canada?
So we're amazing. I don't know if you know that. We actually have a few student programs specifically for law students other than PBSC. For example, we offer a summer fellowship. Every year we bring on law students to work for us over the summer, and they get to work on both parts of our mandate. So both reviewing claims of wrongful conviction and working on this education piece. So it's really, really fascinating work, and our cases are really, really interesting. We also have an articling position that's funded by the Law Foundation of Ontario.
Wow.
So we go through that process every summer as well to bring on an articling student. So there are other ways. I know here you have an Innocence Club as well.
Yes.
One of the cool things about Windsor is that you get the Innocence Club here. I would just say, you know, if you have questions about it, anybody can reach out to me. My contact's on the website.
Oh, absolutely. And what about those who aren't in the legal field? What opportunities are available for those in the greater Windsor-Detroit community, our listeners here?
I think, you know, just getting involved in, you know, following us on social media and sort of learning about the cause and what it is that we do is really helpful. Obviously, we work with a wide range of individuals, from private investigators to DNA specialists.
Wow.
To forensic psychologists to forensic linguists. I mean, there's so many different types of people that need to be involved in something like this. So
yes.
If you feel you have an area of expertise, you can always reach out to me. And if we are in need of that, you know, we'll get in touch. You know, obviously, because we are a small office, I will say that it is challenging to you know, bring on new people. And our cases, as I said, they're a little bit slower. So please have patience. We're really small and we're doing our best to get to everybody.
Okay, absolutely. And what are those social plugs for people to follow?
So at Innocence Canada, we are on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and we are on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I do all of that too. So, you know.
Oh, of course. Let's go back.
Cool. So up to this point, we've spoken a lot about Pro Bono Canada, the specific project, which is the Wrongfully Convicted Outreach Project, and we've spoken a lot about Innocence Canada. We tied in a lot of pop culture and just went all around the topic as much as we can. So before we let you go, any last thoughts?
Last thoughts. You know, I guess the last thought I would have would be whatever it is that you're passionate about, whether it's this issue or another issue, really, you are empowered as law students in a way that is so privileged. And, you know, just do what you can to take that law degree and really make a difference in this world, even if it's in a small way. You know, hopefully you might want to work on this issue, but there are so many things that can be done to better Canada and to better the world. And I just hope that you go out there and do that.
Absolutely. Well said. I concur.
Thank you.
So from all of us here at Magna Carta Pro Bono Radio, we'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to you, Stephanie, for coming into our show today. We wish you and your other project members great success. We look forward to seeing the results of your hard work. And who knows, maybe next time we'll get more celebrity endorsements.
Who knows?
All right. So remember to tune into CGM 99.1 every Friday at 12 for our next Magna Carta Pro Bono Radio Show. You can also listen anytime, anywhere by going to www.cgm.ca. Your hosts next week will be Charles and Nicholas.